Welcome. Welcome, everyone. My name is Jeremy Druin, and I head up the Missouri Valley Special Collections Department, the local history and genealogy department of the Kansas City Public Library. And now for today's program, which is made possible in part by a grant for the National Endowment for the Humanities. I was excited when I first heard there would be a new book published on Kansas City's brewing history, even more so when I learned that Pete Doolin was the person telling the story. In 2015, he authored the book Kansas City Ale Trail, which examined the rapid growth of craft brewing in Kansas City, a tradition that continues and thrives now 2 years later. He also participated in a panel discussion in this very auditorium that included local brewers talking about their craft and their vision of the future for Kansas City beer and brewing. Pete is a freelance writer with more than 15 years of experience covering food and beverage, business, and lifestyle. His work has appeared in the Kansas City Star, Visit KC, Feast Magazine, the Boston Globe, KCPT's Flatland Magazine, and many other publications. His forthcoming book, Expedition of Thirst, Exploring Breweries, Distilleries, and Wineries Across Central Kansas and Missouri, will be published later this year by the University Press of Kansas. This afternoon, he is here to discuss his latest work, Kansas City Beer, A History of Brewing in the Heartland. Please welcome back to the Kansas City Public Library, Pete Doolin.
Afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming out. It's a beautiful Sunday afternoon, so I appreciate you hanging out here at the library to learn about local history and beer. I'd like to thank the Kansas City Central Library and Special Collections Manager Jeremy Druin for hosting me as part of the Missouri Valley Sunday Speaker Series. And then thanks again also to Stockyards Brewing Company for pouring delicious beer samples. It's very tasty. To begin, I'd like to read a brief poem, Happiness, by Carl Sandburg, that's cited in the preface to Kansas City Beer. Happiness. I ask professors who teach the meaning of life to tell me, what is happiness? And I went to famous executives who bossed the work of thousands of men. They all shook their heads and gave me a smile, as though I was trying to fool with them. And then one Sunday afternoon, I wandered out along the De Plain River, and I saw a crowd of Hungarians under the trees with their women and children and a keg of beer and an accordion. So, I think it's appropriate that we're here on a Sunday afternoon enjoying a little bit of beer in the spirit of this poem. I don't know if that brings us happiness, but I think it's a good start. So the poem reminds me that happiness is not found in the halls of academia or in the boardrooms of business, but in the time that we spend together as family and friends. In the poem, music and beer are social connectors that bring us together. And Sandburg doesn't tell us what happiness is, but he paints a pretty vivid picture along the riverside, and beer is part of that scene. The river in the poem also reminds me of Kansas City and how it originated along the Missouri River and grew from its east and west bottoms. And the history of local brewing is embedded within the greater history of Kansas City itself, both developed because the Missouri River attracted settlement and fostered trade and industry. And without that, breweries wouldn't have a place here. So as I do in the book, I'd like to briefly summarize the early origins of Kansas City and Westport as well, because they preceded the first breweries by about 30 years. So just going to give a really quick history lesson here. So the French were very prominent in the early part of Kansas City's origins. Francois Chouteau was a trapper that established a trading post in 1822 on the north bank of the Missouri River near today's Chouteau Bridge. 4 years later, a flood wiped out his warehouse, so he built a second outpost a little bit further west, this time on the south side of the river, near today's Columbus Park neighborhood. And his trading post was known as Chouteau's Landing. It attracted traders, trappers, and settlers that gathered in this French-speaking community. Unfortunately, another flood in 1844 wiped out that community. But the French influence remained in the area, as we'll find out later. Meanwhile, this Baptist missionary named Isaac McCoy and his family came to the area in 1831. They settled a few miles further south of the Missouri River, and his son, John Calvin McCoy, established this area. He platted it, and it became known as Westport. He built a trading post at the intersection of Westport Road in Pennsylvania in the heart of what we know as Westport today. He became the town's postmaster and helped really get this community up and running and thriving as a separate settlement from Kansas City a few miles north. John McCoy hired a team of workers to cut a path from the banks of the Missouri River through the woods and limestone bluffs south to his trading post. His landing at the foot of the river was called Westport Landing, and it was this limestone ledge that at the foot of what we know as Delaware and Grant Streets today in the River Market. The reason that he had this landing built and this pathway was to be able to offload goods from steamboats to haul them south by horse and wagon to his trading post, because there were settlers that were coming from the east, stopping in Westport to get gear and supplies, and then head out west on the Santa Fe, California, and Oregon trails. Now, McCoy also gained fame in the 20th century with a place called Westport's, McCoy's Public House, which is a brew pub in Westport. He was the inspiration for the name of this business, and it's located pretty much right at that intersection where he had his trading post. Now, while Westport was thriving, the settlement along the Missouri River, near today's River Market, also began to take shape. McCoy and 13 other men founded the town of Kansas. It was on the former farm estate of a Frenchman, Gabriel Prudhomme, who died in 1831 in a bar brawl. Unfortunately, he left behind a widow, and they had a number of children. I want to say maybe 9 or 13 children. So the poor widow was kind of at the mercy of speculators that really wanted to take on this property. The estate included land along the East Bottoms and the River Market area that we know today, around 5th and Grand. The town of Kansas became the City of Kansas, or Kansas City, easier to say, and it was incorporated by the state of Missouri in 1853. So when did the first breweries come to Kansas City? It wasn't until the late 1850s. Prior to that, whiskey was more available than beer. Why? Well, spirits didn't spoil, and they were easier to transport over long distances. You see, the earliest breweries that were back east in the New England states, which were the former colonies, had English influences with the beer styles. The most popular styles in the country at the time were ales and porters and stouts, all derived from the English. And most towns had a local brewery or brewer that made the beer, but no one was really distributing beer westward yet. You didn't have glass bottles or cans or kegs. They didn't exist yet. And it was impractical and costly to pack beer in barrels and keep it cold and transport it over long distances. So most people drank that did drink would drink wine and whiskey and other spirits. Around the 1840s, German immigrants began coming to this country, and they emigrated from the east through St. Louis along the Missouri River and came to Kansas City. Some of them stayed here. Others continued west into Kansas or further west on the frontier, and some of them moved upwards to the upper Midwest. Now, as they came through the area, the German immigrants played a really key role in the future of beer production in the U.S. They brought with them recipes and technology to produce lager beer. So this lighter, golden, more effervescent beer was a stark contrast from the ales and porters and stouts that were a bit heavier. And lagers, pilsners, and other German styles quickly became the most popular beer styles in the U.S., and it really remains so today. If you drink Budweiser, Coors, Schlitz, the Pabst, any of those macro beers, they all trace back to those German influences. So thanks to the Germans. Now, around the late 1850s, this German immigrant, Peter Schwitzgebel, and his family came to Kansas City from St. Louis. He established Kansas City's first brewery. It was located at 3rd and Oak in the River Market area, and it was known as Kansas City Brewery, or later as 3rd Street Brewery. Schwitzgebel placed an advertisement in the Kansas City Daily Journal a few years after opening this brewery. The advertisement was dated August 8, 1865, and it boldly declared, "I am prepared to furnish the public with the best lager beer made west of St. Louis, also white beer, ale, and porter, having secured the services of a Pittsburgh brewer." So you still have that Eastern influence here in Kansas City with this first brewery. He operated the brewery in the River Market area for several years, and then he lost his property in 1872 in advance of the Panic of 1873, which was this major financial crisis that swept across the country and devastated a lot of businesses. There were only a few other small breweries in the area at the time, during the late 1850s and into the 1860s, before the Civil War. Now, I'd like to step away from breweries for just a moment and give you a little bit of historical context for what was happening in Kansas City and the surrounding region, because I think it ties into the early growth of breweries. My theory is that some of the major conflicts really impacted the growth of business, not only in breweries, but elsewhere in this western frontier town of Kansas City. For example, the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854 gave people in the Kansas Territory, which wasn't a state yet, the right to self-determination of whether they would be a free state or a slavery state. Now, besides the people that were already in this territory, you had northern abolitionists that were coming down from the New England states and coming to this Kansas Territory to influence elections over which way it was going to go. At the same time, you had people that were supporting slavery that were flooding into western Missouri and then coming over to Kansas also to try to influence elections. There were conflicts that were started and violence that was incited in Lawrence and a lot of other towns in what became known as Bleeding Kansas. So you had this tension, this conflict back and forth, and these series of conflicts led to the Kansas-Missouri Border War. Believe it or not, the border wars had nothing to do with college basketball and football. So there are these raids by the Kansas Jayhawkers and the Missouri Border Ruffians that resulted in killing and looting and destruction through all these towns, and it carried over to the Kansas City and Westport area. This all preceded, this issue over slavery, led up to the Civil War, which lasted from 1861 to 1865. Kansas City and Westport were entangled in the Civil War. You have the Battle of Westport and all of this turmoil. Meanwhile, you still have all these settlers that are coming from the east and passing through Kansas City and Westport to load up and move westward. So there's just a lot of turbulent times. And so it's a very unstable climate for opening a business or settling a family and which way things were going to go. Once the Civil War ended, Westport and Kansas City really began to thrive. You had thousands and eventually tens of thousands of people coming through the area, and the city really grew. And that's when the breweries really started to take off. There's one other factor that ensured the prosperity of Kansas City and its future, as well as the breweries. Kansas City was competing against Leavenworth, Kansas, and St. Joseph, Missouri, for a railroad line. In 1865, the Missouri Pacific Railroad was established as Kansas City's first railroad, and it effectively was the end of the steamboat era as that dwindled down, and it ensured the dominance of Kansas City in the region over these other cities. A few years later, in 1869, the Hannibal Bridge was built and opened across the Missouri River. This was at Broadway Avenue next to the Broadway Bridge. You can still see that bridge today And sometimes you'll catch railroad trains that are passing along it. That railroad bridge was a boon for Kansas City's economy. It opened up trade with the bridge and even more railroad lines that came through. So breweries that did exist in Kansas City could start shipping and distributing beer outbound. You had grain and cattle that was coming into the west bottoms of Kansas City in the stockyards. At the same time, breweries that were established in the region outside the area could also now distribute in Kansas City. So you had competition that was ensuing for local breweries. The other major development, besides the railroads and the bridge, was refrigerated rail cars. So they were able to, rail cars could be stocked with beer, packed around these barrels, and beer could then be transported in larger quantities outbound. And so there was an incentive for breweries to start making more beer and distribute elsewhere. A couple other factors were pasteurization was invented, and so it increased the shelf life of beer and this other thing called milk. And then there were stronger glass bottles that were invented, as well as the caps to seal those bottles. And so you could not only transport beer in barrels, but in bottles. And so all these factors, pasteurization, the packaging, kind of came together, and the refrigeration and rail cars, that gave an incentive for breweries to grow larger and set up more factory-style operations and get these economies of scale to be able to make beer and push it elsewhere besides their home market. The smaller breweries that existed in Kansas City around the 1860s and forward either went out of business, they closed for a number of reasons. A lot of them only opened for like a year or two. Others were acquired because they were unable to compete with these larger factory-style breweries or the out-of-town competition. Before I jump into some of the major breweries in the late 1800s, I just want to talk about one other factor that kind of influenced brewing and alcohol in the area. So leading up to national prohibition in 1920, Kansas actually got a head start on state prohibition. Dating back to the 1830s, local towns started enacting a series of laws that prohibited the consumption or production of alcohol in various communities. And this was all because of the temperance movement and characters like Carrie Nation. They were coming in with their hatchets and these protests and busting up saloons. And it was just part of this very conservative moral climate at the time. Around 1881, several decades later, Kansas enacted statewide prohibition against the manufacture and sale of intoxicating liquors. This is 40 years before national prohibition, so Kansas had really swung to one direction over the rest of the country. For the people that lived in Kansas near the West Bottoms and the state line, they got around this by crossing the railroad tracks and the state line, coming over to the Missouri side, where there are plenty of saloons and taverns in an area known as the wettest block in the world. It's a block that is around 9th and Genesee Streets. And at the time, there were 24 businesses along this one block. And like 22 or 23 of them were saloons or taverns. So people could end their shift in Kansas, come over, get some drinks with their fellow Missourians, and then head back home, just crossing the line. To this day, Missouri's alcohol laws generally are more permissive for breweries and consumers than in Kansas. So going back to the late 1860s, you have George Herb, who established the Main Street Brewery at 17th and Main. It's near the Gallup Mat Company, which is right on the Kansas City streetcar line. And this location had a natural artesian well nearby. And the water from that well was used to supply the brewery. In 1868, Herb sold his brewery to George and John Muehlbach. So now we're going to reach the phase where I'm going to focus on three of the major breweries in Kansas City leading up to national prohibition, Muehlbach, Heim Brewery, and Imperial. So in 1868, the Muehlbachs take over the Main Street Brewery, and they install this 4-inch pipe from the artesian well to this brewery They used native recipes from their from Switzerland to produce their beer, and the brewery took off. It thrived and prospered and steadily gained in scale. By 1880, George Muehlbach rebuilt the brewery out of brick and stone, and it was this really large structure, almost like a fortress, and it was known as the Beer Castle. It stood out, it was really prominent. The brewery produced several brands, including Pilsner, and it was so popular, this Pilsner, that it could only be sold in Kansas City. They couldn't keep up with demand to distribute it elsewhere. Kansas City was a beer-drinking town. Around 1884, there was this gentleman from St. Louis that came, Ferdinand Hines Sr., along with his three sons and brewery foreman. They inspected the Star Ale Brewery, which was located at 14th and Main Street. And they looked over the brewery, they purchased the properties, and at the time, Star Ale was the largest brewery in Kansas City, produced about 12,000 barrels a year. The company, once it was acquired, continued operations as the Ferd Heim Brewing Company. Within a few years, in 1887, the Heims purchased a sugar refinery in the East Bottoms, and they built a new brewery there, as well as a bottling warehouse, a fire station, an ice house, and other buildings on this 14-acre property. Today, the East Bottoms is known for businesses like Knuckleheads and Local Pig, the butcher shop, and some other spaces down there. All of that land was owned by the Heims at one point. Part of that property became Electric Park, which was this famous amusement park known for its prominent novel use of electricity. The park had something like 100,000 electric bulbs there. And electricity was this luxury and somewhat novel at the time. The other notable thing about the park was that it had this beer garden. And the beer that was served there was pumped directly from the brewery through this beer tube and could be served directly at the taps there. So it was pretty convenient. The Heim family did pretty well. They installed a streetcar line from further up on the limestone bluffs in downtown Kansas City that would go down to the bottoms to get people to their park and promote their beer. In 1890, the original Heim Brewery at 14th and Main Street was sold to one of the Heim sons, and it was renamed the Bavarian Brewing Company. Now, this brewery didn't fare as well, and a few years later, sales declined, and they shut it down. They shifted production of several brands by the Bavarian Brewery back over to the Heim Brewery in the East Bottoms. Now, what I found interesting about the Bavarian Brewery, which was at 14th and Main, is that when I look at old photos of it, it's this really magnificent structure. It's just glorious. And it was torn down, and it was replaced by a theater at the time. And over multiple decades, that theater changed hands and evolved as entertainment moved from the vaudeville era to the talking movies. Moving forward to today, Alamo Drafthouse on Main Street is this movie theater chain that's known for serving craft beer in the theater, and it operates on or near the spot where beer was once made. So it kind of comes full circle. So the other major brewery that was operating around the time was the iconic Imperial Brewing Company that was established around 1901, and it was in this massive late Victorian building. It's still visible from I-35. As you drive along, and it's on the west side behind Ponax. And it was constructed in stages from 1902 to 1905 in the Romanesque Revival style. The brewery was established by the St. Louis businessman and a group of investors, and they spent about, they had forecasted about $150,000 in construction costs, and then allotted another $50,000 in operating capital, which was a lot of money in dollars at that time. The brewery used water from nearby Turkey Creek, which ran through the west side at the time. It had its own power plant and used this advanced boiler system for the production of beer. It also had its own stables, where they housed draft horses and mules that would haul beer on wagons to the saloons and taverns throughout the town. Now, advertisements kind of tout the production capacity of this brewery at 100,000 barrels per year, which was just massive. In time, once they got done with construction, the estimates of the cost was around $500,000, a half million, which is way more than what they originally intended to spend. And odds are that the advertisement probably boasts a little bit. Their production capacity was probably closer to 50,000 barrels, which is still pretty sizable. Because of these cost overruns in production and the construction of the brewery, it overwhelmed the investors, and they became saddled with this debt. In December of 1905, they sold the brewery. It was purchased at auction for $99,500 by Kansas City Breweries Company. This company, Kansas City Breweries Company, was formed by a group of Cleveland investors that came in, and they not only acquired Imperial, but they purchased the Heim Brewery in the East Bottoms and yet another brewery called Rochester. And so these three breweries were under this one umbrella, and each one operated independently, producing brands that were separate from each other. It was the biggest brewery at the time, consolidated altogether. Meanwhile, you have Mulemach Brewery, which is still operating, and it's just chugging along and growing. By 1910, Mulemach Brewery, their capacity reached 80,000 barrels a year, and a few years down the road, it reached 100,000. So it was the second largest brewery at the time in Kansas City. Of course, the Mulebach family is well known for the other ventures that it went in. It did really well in the brewery business. It established the Mulebach Hotel, which is now part of the downtown Marriott. They got into other businesses, a lot of real estate, and they also acquired property in the 18th and Vine area and built the Kansas City Municipal Stadium, where the Kansas City Blues and the Negro League Monarchs played. So you have these large factory-style breweries that are operating, Mulebach and then the Kansas City Breweries Company and a few other smaller ones. But really the name of the game was to get big and to produce as much as you could and distribute and get market share. Then Prohibition happened, 1920 to 1933, and that killed the brewing industry in Kansas City as well as the rest of the nation. Not only brewing, but wineries and any sort of alcohol. There were a few breweries, I think including Mulebach, that did produce near beer. So it had like just a trace amount of alcohol. And of course, in Kansas City, the era of Boston Pendergast, there was still the booze that was flying around. And it was in warehouses, and the police were paid to kind of turn a blind eye to these speakeasies. And so there were still booze that was available. But as far as being an owner of a brewery or manufacturing alcohol, it was really illegal. The feds were going to come down on you. So that really curtailed the end of brewing here locally. Now, after Prohibition ended in 1933, the Mulebach family reorganized and they started up the Mulebach Brewery once again. In 1938, they opened the second version of Mulebach Brewery, but this time they moved it to River Market area, 4th and Oak. And it was this huge campus. It occupied an entire city block. And there were multiple buildings there. And today, there's only a couple buildings that still remain. There's one that's, I think it's on Independence Avenue around 4th Street, and on the cornerstone at the top of the building, you can actually see the name Mulebach there. There's another building close by that I ran into some folks that where the building was sold and they had done some renovations and they believe that that was part of the original Mulebach complex. It's really sturdy and was made for production. So Mulebach is in operation again, and they continue to grow and expand their operations in Texas and Louisiana. They're spreading out their sales in these states, in Kansas City, and throughout the Midwest. World War II starts, And that impacted the future of the brewery. By this time, around World War II, their capacity had jumped to 375,000 barrels a year. It's like they're really, really big. But the brewery was facing shortages in grain and metal and other supplies because a lot of this is going to the war effort. Another factor that impacted Bilbock Brewing was that it was starting to lose market share to breweries in the upper Midwest, such as Schlitz and Pabst. Schlitz in particular was really moving into the market. And in fact, the baseball stadium that the Mulebachs had built, they kind of lost the rights to what beer was going to be sold there to Schlitz. And so for a while, Schlitz was the hometown beer in Kansas City instead of Mulebach. So Mulebach's fighting this battle against these major out-of-town competitors for market share. Eventually, it changed ownership several times, going into the 1950s. And then it was acquired by Schlitz. And Schlitz eventually closed Mulebach's facilities in 1956. One of the problems for Mulebach was that it failed to transition from this regional powerhouse into a national brand. That was really kind of the name of the game at that point in the brewing industry, to have this really large economy of scale, to keep your manufacturing costs down, but also expand your sales and distribution to compete for market share and really establish yourself as a brand. The closure of that brewery ended an era of Kansas City brewing in the 20th century. So it wasn't until 1989 when this other brewery started up, which was Boulevard Brewing Company, and it revived Kansas City's modern-day brewing industry. That same year in Lawrence, Free State Brewing opened up as well. This is a brew pub that opened up in downtown Lawrence. And that was historic and significant because for more than 100 years since those prohibition laws were passed in the state, alcohol manufacturing wasn't allowed. Chuck Majerle, the founder of Free State Brewery, had to work with the legislature to get those laws overturned in order to be able to establish his brewery. So in the early 90s, you had Boulevard, and there were a few other production breweries that started up, including Pony Express Brewing and then Flying Monkey Brewery, trying to compete with Boulevard. The 1990s also saw brew pubs that were opening up, these combination of breweries and restaurants, such as 75th Street Brewery, Mill Creek Brewery and McCoy's Public House in Westport, River Market Brewery, and then Power Plant Brewery in Parkville. One of the major developments that affected microbrewing and craft beer in the 1990s was all these people were jumping into the market. Everybody was trying to make a fast buck and promote their brand, and quality suffered. The beer started to suck. And that's not all of it, but a lot of consumers were not willing to pay a premium for this really cool brand and the beer just being inconsistent. Some of the brands that survived, such as Boulevard, really paid attention to that quality aspect, and they focused on their hometown market and building that local and regional audience and just having a consistent product all the way through. A lot of other major breweries around the country tanked because they didn't understand what they were doing and what the market would pay for. So jumping forward to the 21st century, Boulevard Brewing is now in its 28th year of operation. They sell in 38 states in the US, District of Columbia, and a number of countries around the world. They're this major regional brewery. They were acquired by Duvel Morgat, this Belgian brewery, which means it's no longer locally owned, but it's still very much locally operated and still the hometown brewery. In around 2013, 2014, you had the next wave of craft brewing happen. And by craft, I mean instead of these mass market macro beers that are being produced in factories, you have these smaller local breweries that were being established. And some of the first ones in Kansas City were Martin City Brewing Company, Cinder Block, and The Big Rip in North Kansas City. There was also Green Room Burgers and Beer, this little nano brewery in Westport, Rock and Run Brewery in Liberty, and then Kansas City Beer Company in Waldo. And then 2014, Torn Label Brewing opened in the Crossroads, and then Crane Brewing opened in Raytown. So within the span of a couple of years, you have a half a dozen or more breweries that are popping up, not only in the urban core, but in the outskirts of Kansas City and in the suburbs, Liberty, Raytown, North Kansas City. So it's being spread out. Every year since then, we've had an average of 3 to 4 breweries that have opened up. So in 2015, there was Double Shift and Border Brewing that opened in the East Crossroads, practically right next to each other, as well as Red Crow Brewing Company that opened in Spring Hill, Kansas, which is on the outskirts of Olathe. So again, you have breweries that are opening in different parts of the community to serve people in that area. It's kind of a throwback to like the earliest days of Kansas City brewing where you had your neighborhood breweries. Last year in 2016, Calibration Brewery opened in North Kansas City, becoming the third brewery in North Kansas City. Brewery Imperial opened in the Crossroads, and that name, spelled with an E, is kind of an homage to the original Imperial Brewing Company. And then Stockyards Brewing Company, which we sampled today, is located in the West Bottoms. So far this year, there's Smoke Brewing and Fringe Beer Works, which opened in Lee Summit downtown. We've got 4 other breweries that are scheduled to open at least this year. So there's still lots of growth that's happening. Now, I'm asked a lot about the future of brewing in Kansas City, and are we getting to a saturation point? Are there too many breweries? And really, my answer is no. There's plenty more room for more beer. There's plenty of room for it to be produced and distributed and consumed, as long as there's that consistent quality. We don't want to go back to the 1990s where you open a bottle of beer and you don't know if it's going to be good or not, because you are paying your premium for this craft beer. Craft beer drinkers have really embraced local brewing, but again, it needs to be good, not just local. There's plenty of room for smart business models and different ways to get your beer out there and to have it be in your brewery tap room or in retail, grocery stores and liquor stores, as well as event venues. There's plenty of room for innovation and growth and ways to adapt. So I encourage you to get out and visit your local breweries and try some of them and see what they offer. There's a wide range of styles and things from the more exotic to old school lagers and pilsners. So that kind of concludes my talk. If you have more information or questions about my books, you can find more information about me and my books at petedoolin.com. And I'm happy to answer any questions you have. I'll do my best to answer them as much as I can. And then after the Q&A, I'll be selling books outside in the lobby. So yes, sir. Sure. Currently or like historically? Sure. I think what's interesting is that of the new breweries that have opened up in the since 2013 and forward, those earliest ones that are now around 3 years old, quite a few of them have gotten to the point where they have started to bottle and or can so that they can, the way the laws work in Missouri, since Prohibition, there's a 3-tier distribution system. So you have your brewery, your alcohol manufacturer, a distributor, and then like the retail. So breweries can't sell directly to consumers the way they did before Prohibition. So breweries have to produce X amount, and like this, you can sell a little bit at your tap room if you have the right licenses, but you really have to get to the point where you can produce beer in kegs for the distributor, and then to even make it more accessible for people to drink the beer at home or elsewhere, you go to bottles and cans. And so I'd say the majority of the newer breweries are moving to packaging in bottles and cans as quickly as they can. So any other questions? Yes, I'll start right here, and then we'll move over to you. I believe that there's somewhere between 350,000 and, I would say right around there, 350,000 to 400,000. Now they have the production capacity for at least 600,000. So if the sales supported it, like they could make 600,000 barrels of beer per year. So you look back at where Muehlbach was at its height, it was around 300, well, I think it was at least 375,000, maybe even a little bit higher. And so Boulevard is kind of at that historic level of what they're actually producing. That's still, when you compare it to the mass market brewers, Anheuser-Busch and the others out there, it's a drop in the bucket because they're doing multi-million barrels per year. So do we have a question back here? Yes. Well, I think it was really just people that are really wanting to take a chance. So in the late 80s, early 90s, you had craft beer, or back then it was called microbrew beer as an alternative to macro brew beer. And it actually started on the coast, as a lot of things do. So you had people that were making microbrew beer in the New England states, and then there was Sierra Nevada. I think they got started in 1984 in California. And they were making these different styles of beer that had more pronounced hops in them. So beer is made out of four ingredients, yeast, hops, water, and malt, yes, malt. Thank you. So Sierra Nevada and some of these other breweries were starting to put more hops in there, which add a little bit more of that bite on the back end and just more pronounced flavor. And it was catching on elsewhere. Sierra Nevada, their pale ale, was actually inspiration for John McDonald of Boulevard Brewing to try his own beer. I guess like the second part of that answer is that there were all these home brewers that were using these beer kits and they were doing stuff at home or in their garages, their studios, and they're wanting to, you know, they're sharing it with their friends, and it was just a different taste than what you could get at the grocery store or at the bar. And that taste kind of caught on. So John McDonald wanted to make a better version of the pale ale than what Sierra Nevada did, one that was more to his liking. And that's where he came up with pale ale, the first beer that was produced by Boulevard as its flagship. So yeah, I think it was just people that were wanting an alternative in the market and to try something different. Yes. So there's two of them, and they're both located downtown, I believe on 3rd Street, or maybe it's Main Street. It's Main Street. So Smoke is, they just opened maybe less than 2 months ago. And it's a brew pub, so they have barbecue as well as their own beers there. And just a few doors, practically in the backyard, there's Fringe Beer Works, which is a small little tap room. And they have you can see the brewery system from the tap room there. And they have started to introduce a few of their beer styles there. So. Over here, any questions? It was, and if I recall, Country Club was actually produced by Getz Brewing, which is based out of St. Joseph. And I didn't spend a ton of time on out-of-town breweries that had operations in Kansas City, just for the sake of space in the book, because there was lots of competition, as I mentioned earlier. You had these out-of-town breweries that set up these branches and depots along the railroad lines and where they would take orders and try to get their beer in the local bars and saloons. Getz Brewing was one of the biggest breweries in the area that had operations in St. Joseph. For a while they had, I think, some brewing operations in Kansas City, but they also had like a major bottling operation here and employed hundreds of people. And one of their brands was Country Club, that was pretty prominent. Yes? Good question. That's a complex question, because it varies by state. As I mentioned, Missouri's always been a little bit more progressive with its laws, and every state's different, which vexes the breweries, the wineries, and distilleries that are trying to expand from Kansas City, and what are the laws in that state, and how can I sell it, and it's a really complex web. The three-tier system is one of the foremost systems of regulation and distribution. It's probably a little bit outdated, but I don't know enough about the intricacies of how that system works and like why it varies from state to state, but I think part of it really goes back to local politics and morals and what people feel is good for the state. And it, to me, it doesn't make a lot of sense because, you know, Kansas, which is hurting for tax dollars, has Colorado on, you know, to the west, that's just going gangbusters with breweries there. And, you know, lots of money is being made off of taxes from the manufacture and consumption of beer there. On the other side, you've got Missouri, which is really growing. You know, there's far more breweries in the Kansas City area and throughout the rest of the state than in Kansas, as well as wineries. So it doesn't make sense to me why Kansas wouldn't promote its brewing industry and make it easier. They're taking baby steps, but that's a more complex question than I could really get into.
No.
No.
Yeah. I think, yeah, Kansas, like, they're trying to update their laws, but I think they're still like 3.2. So generally, so the question was, what's the difference in full-strength beer versus the lower alcohol? So in Kansas, for a while, it was 3.2% beer, which is anything like 4% or lower is relatively low alcohol. I mean, you'd either have to be pretty susceptible to the influences of the alcohol or drink quite a bit of it to be intoxicated. A lot of beers on the market in that middle range would be 5 to 6%. And then there are, with craft brewing and brewers exploring these styles, you have anywhere from 7% up to the teens. And you know, with the production of alcohol, it's manipulating how much alcohol is produced from the yeast that's consuming the grains in the brewing process and where they want that alcohol level to be based on the style. Yeah, and it's all, you know, it traces back, you know, more than a century, like these decisions and just that climate. And, you know, I think there are some people today that are, you know, more progressive and, you know, they want to be able to buy their alcohol and would like the laws to be changed, but it's easier said than done. So a couple more questions. Yes, sir. Not that I've come across that. I mean, that would make sense. I mean, I know a lot of breweries today, they'll make arrangements with farmers to dispose of their spent grain to feed cattle, you know, pigs and cows, so there's no waste there. But I didn't come across anything regarding dairies. I'm not sure, but my guess would be you know, with the stockyards in the West Bottoms that you know, a lot of these breweries operate in that same proximity, so it probably went to the stockyards to feed cattle down there. Otherwise, I'm not sure. All right. Any other questions? Oh, okay.
Thank you for
Thank you.